And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. Our live shows are right here at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Please remember to visit the website, podcastufo.com. Check out the latest blogs and forums. And while you're there, don't forget to like our very active Facebook page.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. Sam Maranto will be joining us in a second. We're coming at you live on the Dark Matter Radio Network. You can catch us here every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can call in during our live show or Skype us, and I'll give you more information later on. Our guest for the show today is Dr. Kevin Randall, who I always think of as a no-nonsense guy. He says it the way it is, and that's what I like about Kevin, and he'll be coming up in a little while after the break. Well, Sam, I want to talk to you about California. I lived out there for about 9 years, and a lot of stuff's been going on, a lot of hoaxing, and of course, everybody's been talking about the crop circle. So I have a little bit of beef with California, Sam.
I think I do, too, a little bit.
Yeah. Did you remember the other day I emailed you right after New Year's Day, right after we did our show, and I said to you, look at all these UFO sightings on New Year's Eve. They're all Chinese lanterns. And laughable, isn't it?
Oh, there was gobs of them. And pretty much all I had to do was look at the footage. Some of them I don't know because I didn't see all the footage. And they were saying it was throughout the state pretty much or...
Yeah, people were setting off fireworks and setting off Chinese lanterns at the same time. That's basically what was going on. However, there was one guy that said he saw one take off at a high rate of speed, and either that was not the truth, so to speak, or he thought he saw something.
Yeah, it could either be the way he was looking at it, or it could be something legit. We've had, in fact, last year? Yeah, it was last year, of course. Anything happened last year. I was speaking at the Plainfield Library, and a woman told me about an experience on the 4th of July. They were at a baseball game, and this huge triangular object just sat there over the baseball game. And she looked up, and she was in awe, and there was like six or seven of them looking, but the rest of them were too engrossed in the game to even pay attention to this thing. Clearly a triangular object sitting perfectly still, and it was huge, directly over the field.
Have you noticed how these UFOs seem to be sports fans?
They sure are.
Yeah, I'm seeing this a lot.
I know they like baseball, so that's good.
Yeah, it's American pastime.
They get points with me. I love baseball.
Right. So next, I want to talk to you about the crop circle that's gone viral. And, of course, has come out that it was just a advertising ploy. But right when that happened, that was all over the news, just like the UFOs. And that was in, I think it was like Chula or something like that, California. There was a guy named Brian Anderson who emailed me the next day, and he said, that is some type of marketing ploy, some type of chip. He works in the technical field, and he knew right away that's what it was. And so I forwarded that to Nancy Talbot, our past guest that does crop circle research. And you can go on her website now, BLT Research. She has articles on that about the findings. But again, another hoax. And, you know, it really works when they're advertising like this because, you know, they get a lot of media. And it's really unfortunate for all of us. More things to muddy the water, basically.
Oh, absolutely. And the thing was, when I looked at it right off the bat, I go, that's a chip.
Yeah.
It was just look at it. If you're going to see, like, what is it a depiction of? It's a chip.
Well, you know, it's funny how this guy wrote me and said a lot of people didn't get it. He didn't understand why. But another thing, I listened to Coast, I guess I can say that, and Linda Moulton Howe, who I actually like, but she kind of goes out there a bit sometimes without doing any research. And she had all kinds of people involved. They broke the code of 192, and she said, okay, 192 days from the day that was made. is July 8th, and the planets will be arranged in a 192 formation. And this is a warning, and it also is plutonium that could be dirty bombs, you know, on and on and on, out to like 12 million people or 20 million people, whatever Coast to Coast has. I mean, wow, I don't know. Things like that just, you know, I just think you have to be so careful before you come to conclusions, especially of that magnitude.
And people say, why does it take you so long to come out with a case? Tinley Parksman, how long? Well, I'll tell you why. This is the prime example. Put it together right, make sure everything's correct, and present the correct information, whatever it is, but make sure it's correct.
That's right.
Again, the other thing is we keep forgetting with Linda, more importantly, she is a journalist. And mm-hmm. a journalist has to have a story and has to publish. She has spots on these shows that she has to bring information in. And I don't slight her for that, but I do think, I don't think, I know the, because of that, same thing with Hamid Mossad, who I have tremendous amount of respect for all these people. They jumped the gun to grab the story and put it out there. I don't think that is the prudent way to go about it. Now, with the resources that they have, she did, I'll give her credit this much, she did get the 192, but I, me personally, I, Julie came in and said, did you hear about this crop circle? And I'm on the computer already working on it that morning. And sure enough, and I says, well, I'm looking. And I go, that's a computer chip of some sort, except for the exterior orbs or whatever they're supposed to be. And who knows, but that's a chip. That's what a chip looks like. And sure enough, that's what it was.
Now, going back to what Nancy Talbot just told me a few minutes ago, she had contacted and got a hold of someone that was working a farm tracker in the field right next to where they were making the glyph and watched them make it. So, you know, it's a wonder that story didn't get out right away before this whole thing went viral.
Yeah, that should have been nabbed right away. Unfortunately, Nancy and Linda don't particularly share too much information. That's part of another problem we have in the research field is people like to be very territorial about their research, and understandably within reason. But when it comes to something like that, I don't care. If I knew another person was working on a case and I caught wind of something, I don't care who it was. It could be somebody that really doesn't make me too happy. I'd still contact them because I wouldn't want to make them have them look like a fool. The other thing is it does give us sort of a black eye, making us look like a bunch of nincompoops.
I think so. This whole thing, you know, in California, just what has transpired over the last week, it certainly doesn't help the UFO field in any way, that's for sure. I think that'll do it for this week. And so, Sam, we'll see you back here next week.
Most certainly. And I'm busy on cases. So
yeah, I heard that. You had six come in today. Well, we should be talking about that pretty soon, how
yep.
busy you are.
And say hello to Kevin for me. Great guy and excellent researcher. I'll tell you one thing, you're going to have a great interview with him.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. All right, everyone, it's time for the break, so hang in there, and we'll be right back with Kevin Randall. This song that I'm going to be playing right now, it's a shortened clip by a fan of the show. It seems like we have a lot of fans of the show that are musicians, and the band name is Suivolk. It's kind of hard to pronounce. The link to their website will be right in our show notes. And as always, what Sam and I were just speaking about will all be in our show notes as well. All right, so that's it. Stay with us. Thank you.
that you might be unable to cope with. I think our training and all the work that goes into the preparation for flight does everything it can toward erasing those kinds of possibilities. And I would say that as a crew, we have no fear of launching out on this expedition.
Wow, that sounds like Bob Lazar. Kevin, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Kevin. Well, thanks so much for joining us, and it's a real pleasure to have you on. And like I said in the intro there, I know you as a no-nonsense type of guy, so it's a pleasure we finally connect.
Well, I'm glad to finally get a chance to chat with you.
Yeah, you know, Kevin, could you tell the listening audience that may not be familiar how you got into the field to begin with? And, you know, you have a great military background. You have a PhD. And just can you just kind of go into your whole background?
You mean there are people who don't know who I am already?
Well, there's one or two, you know, we're in some other country, maybe.
Have they not heard of Wikipedia?
I have your page up right in front of me right now.
I
can read it. I'll read it verbatim. How's that? No.
Great, if you'd like to. No, I think, you know, part of the question was, how did I get interested in this?
Yes.
And I always blame my mother for that. She had an interest in science fiction, and I remember as a kid she dragged me to a movie called Earth versus the Flying Saucers. And so that is how I kind of got interested in it in the beginning. So I always blame her for that. I have retired from the military. I retired in 2009 as a lieutenant colonel. I spent a tour in Vietnam as a helicopter pilot. I spent some years in the Air Force, both active and reserve time as a intelligence officer, and then I did the same thing with the National Guard with a tour in Iraq in 2003-2004, and then retired, as I said, in 2009. I've studied UFOs since I was a kid. There's no other way to put it. It's the only way I can say it. Found some interesting things, learned a lot of stuff about it, and find that in the world today, a lot of the people who are involved with UFOs are more interested in having their opinions validated rather than finding out what the truth is. They will say, well, what's your opinion on this case? And I'll explain why I find the case interesting or I don't find it interesting. And if it's one that they're really into, then they become angry with me because I've badmouthed their case. And they've asked me for what my opinion is on a specific case or a specific event. So there's really nothing more I can do than tell them what I think the truth may be, which is not to say I can't be wrong on some of this stuff, but there's an awful lot of information out there about what's going on, and I think we need to look at it in depth. And one of the things we just did on my blog was I had put up a short posting about the Tremonton, Utah film from July 7th, 1952, taken by a Navy warrant officer. And by going through the documentation available, the Condon Committee report on that, the Air Force Project Blue Book files, and all of that stuff, we found out some very interesting things in today's environment. And one of the things we can point to is the Condon Committee. They say, well, they investigated all this stuff. Turns out that the chief investigator on that particular sighting didn't even bother to talk to the man who took the film. All he did was read the Air Force file and say, well, it's probably birds, and let it go at that. It's just a preposterous way to do research. So it's not only the UFO community that does some of that stuff, but it's the alleged scientific community as well.
Right, right. And what are you working on these days? We can talk, you know, go back to, you know, you were such a major researcher in the Roswell case. We can talk about that in a little bit. But what are you doing these days?
I've got a book coming out in May, I find out from other people. I guess the publisher didn't bother to communicate with me, but I have a book coming out in May about the what's found in the government files. And what I had done was go back and look at a lot of the cases that have come up, and there's government files on those, Project Blue Book files on them or other government files, and looked at this stuff in depth. One of the cases that I looked at was the JAL, I think it's 1629 case from the mid-1980s where an airline crew, a Japanese airline crew, had seen a flying saucer, seen some kind of a craft. And it turns out, I had a chance to talk to the FAA chief investigator on it, just briefly about that to get his opinions. But what is interesting is they have 30 minutes of radar tracking recorded on this thing so they could reconstruct the sighting in great depth, so that there's an awful lot of data about that. And this investigator, John Callahan, told me that they had gone to the White House to present that data. And CIA agents had been there, CIA representatives, and they said, "We're not here. You know, just show what you have. We're not here." And so, I mean, here's a case where we know the CIA has had some interest in it. We know that the thing was tracked on at least two different radars, although I think, based on what I can find, the source of the radar signal is the same. But what it had is there's one radar station. Its signal went to the FAA and to the Air Force, and the signal discriminations were set differently on the two radars because of the missions of the two different organizations. So it looks like there may be two radars, but not really, and things like that. So yeah, I looked at all of that kind of stuff and kind of brought it to the forefront. And in the course of that, I found an article that had just appeared in an Alaskan newspaper where they kind of badmouthed the case and made it look like the pilots were a couple of buffoons. So I sent them an email, and I said, you know, that's not quite right, and you really ought to look at this stuff. And they said, well, can you send us a letter to the editor? So I did. And then they wanted it shortened, so I did. And then they wanted something else. And I said, you know, this really doesn't interest me. I was just informing you your facts are wrong. Hmm. And you should look at this stuff in depth rather than just, if you're going to offer an opinion, you're obligated to make sure you've got the information accurate. You cannot just make a pronouncement on the case because that's what you think is true. And too often in the media now we see that sort of thing. We see it constantly from the best of the alleged journalistic community to the and I hesitate to say it, down to the bloggers, because I'm a blogger myself. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, they're just throwing out what they would like it to be as opposed to what it really is.
Right, right. There is a lot of that. And, you know, mainstream media, you know, these things happen all the time. And, you know, I can't understand what's happened to journalism and
Well, 60 Minutes just got hammered for this Benghazi story they did, this big story on what happened at Benghazi, and it turned out they're in some kind of a symbiotic relationship with the publisher of the guy's book. So it's really not an investigative piece by CBS News. It's really a puff piece and a commercial for this guy's book.
Wow.
And they got hammered on it quickly, and they withdrew the story, and they withdrew the book, and the journalist who did the story, she's now on leave, and I suspect she won't be back.
Yeah,
but because she didn't do some things that you would expect a journalist to do, and that's kind of one of the things I do. In this big thing about the Newhouse, Utah film, one of the things I had mentioned in my blog posting on it is I talked to Newhouse in 1976, and the skeptics jump on me and says, "Well, these memories of his that are 25 years old are no good because he didn't report this in the beginning and all of this jazz." And I said, and the only reason I mentioned it was to say that I'd talked to the guy. And the investigator from the University of Colorado study, the scientific study, couldn't even make that claim. He hadn't talked to the guy. And all I wanted to do was make sure that some of the reports I'd read about what he had supposedly said were accurate, which I thought, you know, just basic journalism 101. Call the guy and say, "Did you really say this?" And he says, "Yeah, I did the same thing with Bill Brazel in Roswell." Before I really did anything with it, I called Bill Brazel on the phone, and it was really hard to find his number. I called New Mexico and asked for Capitan, and they said yes. And I said, "Bill Brazel," they gave me the number. "You can call New York City, and they won't give you the number of somebody in the same building with them, but I can call New Mexico and get Bill Brazel's phone number." So I called him and chatted with him briefly about it to find out if what he had been quoted as saying was accurate. And his answer was yes, pretty much. And I had an opportunity then to meet with him on several occasions and talk to him on several occasions about what he had seen and what he had done.
Wow. And was that Max? Was that his son?
Well, no, that was Bill Brazel. Mac Brazel had died, I think, in 1963.
Yeah.
I think that's the date. So we were talking to the son, but Bill Brazel had interacted with his father, of course, and Bill Brazel had picked up some of the debris. He'd seen the gouge left by the craft when it came down. He'd found bits of the debris. So in that respect, he's a firsthand witness. So we could get some of that, and I was able to verify what he said. And I find, you know, if you look at some of these UFO books, they're reporting what others have reported. They don't bother to check out the data themselves to make sure it's accurate. The way I know Brad Steiger, I knew the code to get in touch with him. I knew how to find Brad Steiger and where he was. And I was looking at the story of the kid that disappeared in Wales back in 1909. And so I called Brad Steiger to ask him. I said, no, that's a hoax. And he'd found out it was a hoax after he published in his book. And I thought, well, A, that was very cool of Brad Steiger to tell me that. And B, I was able to verify from the researcher what had happened, and therefore I didn't make the same mistakes that others had made about reporting this thing as if it was real and accurate.
Right. Now, are you still involved at all in doing the ongoing research in Roswell?
Very little. I'm more geared toward this Project Mogul thing, only because it's such a preposterous explanation. I can't believe anybody takes that explanation seriously. And what we've discovered is, boy, and I hesitate to do that because Charles Moore is dead and can't defend himself. But we found a real inaccuracy in what he was doing, and he had to know it. And so he was perpetuating a myth so that he could be the guy that launched the Roswell case. But what he had done was change the launch time of flight number four. I mean, the flight number four was canceled, so it didn't fly. And we know they did a service flight, which was a cluster of balloons with a sonoboy, a microphone on it, which is not a full Mogul array. But Moore changed the data from the launch time, which would have been the normal launch time for the Mogul arrays in that period in New Mexico would have been just after dawn. He had to change it to 3 o'clock in the morning to make the winds aloft data work.
Wow.
He had to know what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And you can argue the winds aloft data and what it means. I think Brad Sparks and David Rudiak has done some work on that and suggested that Moore had manipulated the numbers. And I'm inclined, if you've got an atmospheric physicist telling you one thing and two guys who are not atmospheric physicists telling you something else, I'm inclined to go with the atmospheric physicist. I would go with Charles Moore's calculations on where the thing went based on his education. But then something that's very easy for all of us to understand is the fact that he changed the time. In the original calculations he'd done, he mentioned the launch time was right after dawn at somewhere around 5:15 in the morning in July of 1947. And all the other flights in June of 1947, all the other flights that were launched right after dawn. So we know that, and yet he had to back the time up to 3 o'clock in the morning to make the winds aloft data work. So in one report he said it was launched at just after dawn, and another report it launched at 3 o'clock in the morning. He had to know what he was doing. The CAA, which is a forerunner to the FAA, prohibited launches of these big, long arrays in the dark because pilots couldn't see them. They could fly into these 600-foot arrays and cause a catastrophic failure.
Mm.
So they had to be launched without any cloud cover. And so if you've got some cumulus clouds going up there, it doesn't even have to be much of a cloud cover. They couldn't launch because the clouds could hide these things, and they couldn't launch it in dark. So they couldn't have launched it at 3 o'clock in the morning. And in the diary, the documentation from the time says the flight had been canceled. So, I've been looking into that sort of thing. We found a lot of other stuff, which gets really into the minutia of it. But in the aggregate, what you end up realizing is that Moore's analysis, Moore's report on it, simply isn't accurate. The documentation does not support what he says.
Yeah. Now, when did you first get involved in the Roswell case to begin with?
It would have been in 1988. The Center for UFO Studies, in looking at, I guess, the Moore and that would be Bill Moore as opposed to Charles Moore, Bill Moore and Charles Berlitz book on the Roswell incident, and some of the things that Stan Friedman had done and said, realized that there was an awful lot of work to be done. And so they proposed a reinvestigation of Roswell. And I was invited in because they knew who I was, and I'd worked with them on some things, but they invited me in. By coincidence, I had been at a science fiction convention June of 1988, and there was going to be a big debate on UFOs, science fiction writers against these guys coming up from the center. I was going to be arguing with the science fiction writers against the guys at the center. And when we got ready to go, it turned out one of the guys couldn't make it from the center, so it would have been three science fiction writers against one guy from the center. So I switched sides because it's a debate. And you can do that in debate. You're supposed to, in a debate, you're supposed to be able to argue either side. So I figured I'll just argue the UFO side, and got to talking to, turns out to be Don Schmidt. And they remembered that in my military background. So they asked if I would participate in this investigation of the Roswell case. And I said, sure, why not? So Don and I went there in February of 1989. I talked to Bill Moore, Bill Brazel. I talked to Bill Brazel in late 1988, and sent him a letter and asked him, you know, if he would meet with us, which he agreed to do. So we met with him in February of 1989 and sat down and chatted with him about what he'd seen and what he'd done. So it's the beginning was, that's a long, convoluted way of getting us to the beginning of the story and how I happened to meet Bill Brazel. It was really funny is afterwards, he wouldn't meet with anybody else. He would meet with us whenever we're there. We'd look forward to meeting with us. He took us out to the debris field where he found his stuff, and it's 8 o'clock in the morning, and we're riding in his ratty old red pickup truck. He's got a six-pack of warm beer with him, and he says, you guys want a beer? And the last thing I want at 8 o'clock in the morning is a warm beer.
Oh, goodness.
But I figured one of us ought to drink with him, so I had a warm beer at 8 o'clock in the morning. But he would always meet with us, and I tried to get him to do the Unsolved Mysteries program, and he just wouldn't do it. And I was suggesting to the producers, what you need to do is this, this, and this to get his interest, and he just didn't really have an interest in doing any of that stuff. But he'd always meet with me or with Don and me when we got down there, and then later on he met with Don and Tom Carey when they were down there. So we opened the door, at least for us, to get to talk to him, and I recorded everything he said to us with audio tape. We wanted to sit down with him to do videotape, and he always said he was going to do it. Whenever we were there with the camera, he just wasn't ready to do it, and his long since passed away, so that ship sailed. But we do have auto recordings, both of him in person and on the telephone, of what he said to us, so we can demonstrate that, yeah, he really said this. Doesn't mean it's true, just means we're accurately reporting what the guy told us.
Right, right. Hey, I want to take calls for anyone out there, any listener out there that would like to call in for any question for Kevin. The phone number here is 603-967-4030. That's 603-967-4030. Or you can Skype me at Marty Willis. That's MartyWillis, all one word. What is the most profound thing that Brazel said? Did he actually see the debris himself?
He had scraps of it. He had picked it up. He had said in the couple of years after this event, he had been out on that part of the range, and he said whenever he was out there, he would look down. They did a lot of the stuff on horseback, so he was riding the horse looking down, and he said he found maybe 10, maybe a dozen scraps of this stuff. He found some what he called monofilament fishing line that he said that when you shined a light in one end, it would come out the other, which, of course, means it's fiber optics. He found some debris that it had the density of balsa wood, very lightweight, and he got out his pocket knife. He wanted to take a shaving of it to see if there was any stratification in it. And he couldn't get a shaving with his pocket knife. He said, I used a pocket knife to cut barbed wire, and I couldn't get a shaving on it. And then he said, but the most interesting piece was this little bit of foil. He said it was like I think he said lead foil as opposed to tin foil or aluminum foil. So it's thicker gauge material. And he said he He had it in his chaps pocket, and he pulled it out, and he threw it down on the dresser drawer, and it started to unfold itself, going back to its original shape. And he said, well, then I got to playing with it. So we got some kind of a memory metal going on there. And he said he had it in a cigar shop box. He showed it to his father, who said, yeah, that looks like some of the contraption I found. But he was in Corona, New Mexico, talking to his friends and mentioned that he had this debris. And he said, the next few days, some fellas from the base showed up. I don't know whether it was the Roswell base, Kirtland, Alamogordo. I mean, they're all within easy driving distance of the Brazel Ranch at the time. And he said it was a really nice fellow, a redheaded captain, a couple of an NCO, and a couple of other enlisted guys. And they made it clear to him that he was going to surrender the material. I said, well, we came to get the material, and he surrendered it to them. And then they went out. He showed them where he'd found it, and they spent a couple of hours looking around out there and then left. So he lost that, which would have been a wonderful bit of evidence for the rest of us as well.
Boy. Kevin, just one second here. I want to apologize to the listeners that are listening live right now. I guess there's some type of audio crackling or something going on. I'm recording a nice, clean podcast on this side. You'll be able to come to my website and re-listen. I apologize for that. And instead of just disrupting the whole show, I'll just keep going. But we have a person on Skype, Kurt. How are you?
Hi.
And you have a question for Kevin?
Yes, I do. I was wondering, and I missed the beginning of the show, so maybe you've already talked about this, but Paul Hellyer has been in the news. I'm sure Kevin's seen that, and I just wanted his response to that. And I did want to say, though, as best I can tell, Mr. Hellyer's understanding of UFO began with the briefs of Colonel Corso's book, and I think that's been discredited. So anyway, that's my question, basically.
I think you're right that Corso's book has been pretty well discredited. The tale on how he saw the alien body is militarily makes no sense to me whatsoever as a former intelligence officer. If you're shipping a classified thing, whatever it might be, or records, whatever they happen to be, from point A to point B. And in the military, you have what's called a RON, remain overnight, and you plan your route so you only drive so far every day, and then you stop at the closest military base. You plan your route to pass military bases so that you can stay there. So if I'm the convoy commander and I'm shipping this stuff, the last thing I'm going to do is allow those at the local base access to this classified material. And yet he's talking about how they were in there prying up the lids of stuff and looking at it. It just makes no sense militarily. And there are lots of other problems with Corso's book. I met Paul Hellyer in May of this last year, and he seemed to be a very nice gentleman. He has connections into the Canadian government, and I haven't really looked into those with any great depth, so I'm not sure how credible what he says is. And I know that very credible people sometimes are swayed by people who are less than credible, so that the fact that he is believed what Corso said, and I really should say Colonel Corso, because he did retire as a lieutenant colonel, but then again, who didn't? He may not have had the wherewithal and may not have understood some of the outrageous things that Corso was saying. So the fact that he kind of looked at Corso as a credible source doesn't really undermine Hellyer's credibility. It's one of those things. I mean, there's an awful lot of people. Another fellow is Richard French, and if you look at his military background and what he's claimed about his military background, it's accurate. You know, the guy retired as a lieutenant colonel. You know, once again, who didn't? He had a very distinguished Air Force career, but some of the other things that he said as he went along don't seem to be grounded in reality. But the guy's like 900 years old, so you're not really sure what is going on in his mind at that advanced age. So, you know, you can look at all of this stuff, but I think what you have to do is look at the specific gentleman and say, you know, what he is claiming he personally saw or he personally did, is this a credible story, and look at it from that point of view, as opposed to, well, I believe Colonel Corso type story.
Is that it, Kurt, or do you have another question?
No, that's it. I thank you for answering the question.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. So getting back, Kevin, to, you know, in the beginning, when you were finding all those witnesses, that must have been like a treasure hunt. I mean, maybe not a treasure hunt exciting like that, but it must have been pretty interesting to start meeting with all these people and talking to them about the account of the whole situation.
Well, it certainly was a treasure hunt, and it certainly was exciting. And I remember it being in the hotel lobby in Roswell talking to a fellow down there who we wanted to make contact with simply because we knew he had a lot of photographs and documentation from that era, which could be valuable to us. He had a copy of the Roswell phone book, the base phone book. And that became important because, Walter Hutt had done a yearbook of the people who were at the base, but Walter said that 10 to 20% of the people assigned to the base in 1947 aren't in the yearbook. The phone book gave us another group of names, and some of whom were not in the yearbook, and this woman was talking to us about her cousin or her uncle, Daryl Rasmussen, and he's not in the yearbook, but he's in the phone book, so we could verify that he was there in the proper time frame. So we were talking to him about some of this stuff, and I had just mentioned to him casually that we needed to see if we could find any of the family of Sheriff Wilcox. And this fellow says, "Oh, I know one of his daughters. Will that do?" Yeah. "Can you call her?" And he said, "Sure, he'd call her up." And so we went out the next day and met with her. And it's fun to sit there in the archives and you're going through stuff and you suddenly find the answer to the question. One of the things we did a couple years ago, somebody said, when was the yearbook published? Is this a relevant question? Well, it might well be because it gives you an idea of when they put the thing together and who might have been available, who might not have been available. And what we discovered was the yearbook was published in November of 1947, but it went to the publisher in August of 1947. So it was put together prior and during the events of June and July of 1947 and went away in August of 1947. So the people who were there in the yearbook probably were people who were on the base when this event took place. And so that, that's an interesting discovery and kind of an exciting thing to find. Or finding a document that kind of verifies part of an event or leads you to something else. It's just really kind of fun to find that stuff.
Oh, I bet. And one of the things I've thought of is it seems to me that all these people that were the witnesses, did they quietly talk among themselves? Are you aware of any of that?
Prior to the big blow up of interest in Roswell, which would be
1979 or something like that?
No. That wasn't the big blow up. Jesse Marcel came forward in 1978, early 1978. The Roswell incident came out in either 1980 or 1981, but it wasn't the real blow-up of information. The real blow-up of information came about after Don's and my book was published in 1991, and then Stan Friedman got in with his book as well, and then there was a big blow-up of information. What we found prior to that was these people really didn't talk to one another. But afterwards, then there was a circulating of the information. We found in an article that Inez Wilcox had put together called 4 Years in the County Jail. And the joke was, of course, she was the wife of the sheriff and was sort of the matron of the jail when there were female prisoners and did the cooking and that sort of thing for it. So the joke of the title was she would spend 4 years in the county jail, but as a jailer as opposed to an inmate. And she had the story, and one of the things she talked about was just briefly when this UFO crashed. The problem for us was none of this is dated. The original article doesn't seem to have included that information. It was, I think it was Ad 8, which means she wanted to add it to page 8. So it went in there. So it wasn't part of the original article, but it came about afterwards. So the question then became, when did Inez Wilcox die? Because if she died prior to 1978, well, this is a wonderful piece of documentation. If she died afterwards, then it could easily be contamination. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, and I hesitate to say that because it sounds mean, but unfortunately she died after the Roswell Incident book came out. And I would suspect that while that book didn't make a big impact on the rest of the country, of course it made an impact on New Mexico and it made an impact on Roswell. So I would suspect that there was some discussion in the local newspaper or local TV or radio stations about this UFO crash in Roswell. So at that point, I think she might have revisited her article and put that stuff in there. Doesn't mean it's not true. Doesn't mean that she was not writing it from memory. It just means there's a possibility of contamination, and we can't prove it. One of the best things we found is a two-paragraph statement by Lydia Schleppe. She was the teletype operator at the radio station, I think KGFL was the Roswell station. She was up at the Albuquerque station. I forget what the call sign of it was. But she was the one that was typing the message when it was interrupted and said, do not transmit. Mm. And there's two paragraphs that appear in a Saga magazine in in 1976, I forget the month. But two paragraphs in part of a UFO story about that. Well, clearly, she was not influenced by Jesse Marcel. She was not influenced by the discussion of Roswell. This appeared 2 years prior to that. So that's a nice little piece of evidence for us.
Wow. Wow. When you were finding these people, were there quite a few of them that were still like scared and didn't want to talk about it?
Edwin Easley, who was the provost marshal, told me repeatedly, and I have it on tape, he can't talk about it. He was sworn to secrecy. I don't think he was scared so much as he was honorable and he didn't want to talk about it. He wanted to help us as much as he could, provided us with interesting little tidbits like that Mac Brazel complained about being in jail. But Easley told us he was held in the guest house, which is not exactly a jail, but if the door's locked and there's a guard on the door, then you know, what's really the difference? Mm. Easley gave us that little snippet of information that nobody else had developed, and talked briefly about what he had seen. But when we got specific questions, he would say to me, I can't tell you about that. I was sworn to secrecy.
Have you been following the person that claims they have I think it's a Kodak slide of supposed aliens at Roswell? Have you followed that at all?
Yes, I have.
And what is your, do you want to talk about that at all?
Well, the easiest thing to say is there's no provenance for it.
Yeah, that would be the tough one.
And that's a tough one to overcome. Apparently the slide is old enough to have been taken in 1947, but we don't know who took the slide. We don't know who took the photographs. We don't know where the photographs came from. We really don't know anything about it. There are attempts to verify this, and Kodak, as I understood it, and I understand it from, they said, well, the coding on the film was correct for 1947, and I said, you realize they recycled the codes. Hmm. What do you mean? I said, every 20 years they recycled the code. So the film might have been made in 1947, might have been made in 1927, might have been made in 1967. The cardboard holder would give you a clue as to the age of it, but I haven't seen the slide. But once again, the story of the way the slide developed is sort of alien autopsy light, which simply means rather than have movie footage, they've got just a slide, which is much easier to fake than movie footage would be. I'm very dubious of it because of the lack of provenance, but I know that the investigation is ongoing to verify as much as they possibly can about it. So it's an interesting thing. I do not hold out much hope that it's going to be authenticated. I'm not sure how you can authenticate it without a provenance. But I know that the investigation is ongoing. So you kind of look at it from the point of view, well, I think it's a hoax, but we got to check to make sure, because what if it's not?
Right.
Then we stop the questions and we can move on to other avenues of investigation once we have that sort of, if we have that sort of evidence in our hot little hand, and we say, well, you know, guys, we got a picture of the thing. Now maybe the government would like to tell us what they really know about what happened at Roswell,
right.
Since we can demonstrate something really did happen there. But the slides, like I said, I think there's two of them, basically of a single entity.
Right.
The investigation is ongoing into validating the age of the film, validating as much as they can of what's seen in the background, validating all of those sorts of things. So they're working to do that. I know the guy that owns the slides is a little bit leery of releasing all the information. He wants to control it. It's his slides, and he certainly can control it as he wants to, but he is cooperating with some of the investigators on getting the provenance established and that sort of thing. If they can do that, then they've got a wonderful piece of evidence, and if they don't, then we're MJ-12 all over again. You know, well, we can trace it to here, and that's it.
Mm-hmm. Do you know who, besides the person that owns the slide, are they quietly being shown to any researchers, or is it just right now?
Yes.
Yes.
And it's an ongoing thing. I hesitate to say this because it just infuriates some people, but I was not really a participant in the investigation. I was aware of some of the things going on. I learned of the slides through a blog posting, and I think Nick Redfern provided me with a great deal of information about it that he had learned through his contacts in Texas. And Nick was very forthcoming with me on this, and I learned some additional things, but there is an ongoing investigation in the hands of UFO researchers, and they're moving carefully because we've seen too many of these things blow up
mm-hmm.
when information was released prematurely or other people with other agendas. There are people who have agendas to, you know, it, since there cannot be any alien visitation, ergo anything that shows it must be a hoax type of attitude. And we see this all the time. They just don't want to look at the evidence. They're going to reject the evidence that doesn't fit into their narrow worldview. We see it on the other side of the coin as well, where the true believers, and this is where I get myself into trouble, the true believers want everything validated. You know, do you believe this story? Well, not really. It's not very good. And they become angry because you haven't validated their story. But I try to go where the evidence takes me, and that, I think, makes me somewhat of a pariah to many people.
Well, I think that's the way to go. What type of evidence would you think would really crack this case open? I mean, there's all kinds of witness testimony. There's people that claim that they've held, you know, this unusual fabric material in their hands. There's all kinds of claims like that. But what type of evidence, in short, of actually finding in the ground?
I've often said, you know, we have to develop multiple chains of evidence, and the testimony mm-hmm. is certainly one of change, and it's an important chain. But what we have to do is look at documentation. Is there any documentation? Well, yeah, there is. There's an FBI telex that doesn't really tell us much. There are some newspaper articles from the time that gives us information. I would love to see, and we have not been able to find it, a letter from one of the soldiers at Roswell to family members, dated, you know, like July 9th, 1947, or a diary held by somebody where we've got it. With one diary we found was Ruth Barnett, Barney Barnett being the guy who supposedly saw the crash saucer on the plains of San Augustine. We found a diary for 1947 that gives absolutely no hint Barney Barnett saw anything. In fact, answered some questions for us. I was told of another diary that says this supposedly existed on a ranch in up near the Corona area, but it was in an outbuilding. And in talking to Tom Carey, I discovered he'd been down that path already, and the outbuilding was full of snakes and scorpions, two of my very favorite things. But he couldn't take it any further. And if Tom had not gotten to it, then I certainly wasn't going to get to it, especially if there were scorpions and snakes in the damn building. I wasn't going to be digging around in there looking for a diary. So, I mean, that lead blew up. We've been through all kinds of documentation. I spent hours and hours going through Curry Holden's documentation, Holden being an archaeologist who supposedly saw this thing. He being out of Texas Tech University, and his papers are all at the university, and I spent hours and hours and hours going through his diaries and his records and even his tax statements and his canceled checks. And so, on the July 4th weekend, we couldn't put him anywhere. He wrote a check to an organization, I think, on Friday morning, and the next time he appears is Monday afternoon. And it's a long weekend because of the 4th of July holiday, but we couldn't establish that he was in New Mexico at the time. Could he have been in New Mexico? It's like a three-hour drive from Lubbock to Roswell. Even in that time frame, it wouldn't have been that Herculean a task to get from Lubbock to Roswell. So he could have been there with students at any number of archaeological sites in the area. And a lot of the archaeological sites, for example, are hidden by the archaeologists because they don't want trophy hunters getting in there or pot hunters getting in there, disturbing the sites. So, they're usually very coy about these sorts of things. We could not establish him in New Mexico, but we couldn't establish him in Lubbock either. So, I mean, we look at all that sort of thing, but we cannot come up with the documentation. Frank Joyce, who was the radio announcer at KGFL in 1947, talked to Mac Brazel, according to what Joyce told us. And he said when the story came down, he took a lot of the teletype records and hid them, so that they wouldn't be confiscated. So the military came through and took a lot of stuff, but they didn't get all his records. But his records are not helpful at all. It talks about when the story broke on July 8th, there was a teletype message, is this the hullabaloo that was on the ranch down in there last week? And we're going, well, what's that about? But it turns out that was something that took place in, I think it was Las Cruces. It has nothing to do with the Roswell case, but it took us a while to divine exactly what that hullabaloo was all about. So the documentation, I'd love to find a piece of documentation like that with the known province. So one thing we do have is the picture of General Ramey taken in his office on July 8th, 1947, and he's holding in his hand a piece of paper that, with a magnifying glass, you can actually read some words on it, and we're trying to decipher it, but it's held at an angle. It was the focus was on Ramey and not on the piece of paper, so there's interpretation problems, and we're trying to find a way that we can clarify what the document says, so that if you're of a skeptical mind, we say this is how we were able to determine what it says. Here is the scans. See, you follow these steps, you should come to the same place we are. Let's compare notes. So there would be a wonderful piece of documentation with a known provenance because we know the guy's holding the document. We see him there, and I found the documentation that showed the picture was transmitted at 11:59 p.m. on July 8th, so we know the time. So here's clearly Ramey. It's clearly something that has to do with the Roswell case, because two of the words you can read is weather balloons with a magnifying glass. I mean, a kid with a magnifying glass and an 8x10 can read that much. So we're hoping to be able to clarify more of that. The controversy on that is on a phrase that says victims of the wreck. If it in fact says victims of the wreck, that means one thing, but there are people who interpreted that phrase as saying the remains of the wreck, which is a whole different thing. Remains of the wreck could refer to weather balloon crap, as opposed to, victims suggest biological entities. Remains suggest just debris. So there are things that we're trying to clarify. I hold out a little hope that we're going to be able to do that. We've talked to the right people to get this thing done properly. It's just a question of getting all the pieces now in a row so that we can do what we need to do to find out. But there's been a big controversy about this Ramey memo since the 1990s, and we're hoping that as our technology is now improved, we may be able to clarify some of the sentences and get an idea of exactly what it says.
Isn't there a guy in, like, San Francisco or something that's working on this, like, on a daily basis?
Well, there's nobody really working on a daily basis, but I think you're referring to David Rudiak.
Right.
And he's done an awful lot of work on the Ramey memo, but he's taken it as far as he can take it with the scans that have been made at this point. And so we're hoping that, there's some technology we can now employ that will improve the quality of that sort of thing. And David's aware of what we're attempting to do. David is of the opinion that it says victims of the wreck. I know Tom Carey is the same way, and I've looked at that sentence. And, boy, I can see victims there, but I can also see remains. You know, it's just one of those things where it's just on the edge of legibility. It's just, you know, you're just applying your own perception to it, and it's kind of where you wanted to go. Jim Horan and I had done a scientific experiment with this using a university psychology students. If you ever took psychology in college, you know you're required usually to participate in experiments, so they always have a fresh crop of victims in that. And there were three groups, a control group, of course, which told nothing about the memo. There was a group that said this had to do with atomic testing, and another group that was told it had to be, it had something to do with UFOs, and they were given the thing and the best quality that we had at the time, and they didn't spend anywhere the time that David had spent on trying to investigate it. But those who were told about the atomic aspect of it, the atomic bomb aspect of it, saw things in the memo that suggested the word that springs to my mind that they saw the word flash, like atomic flash. And those who, you know, saw UFO or were told about UFO, saw some UFO-related things. All this did was suggest that there was a certain amount of priming, which is, I'm sure everybody knows, a psychological term means that, you know, you tell somebody this is going to happen, and now they're ready to see that sort of thing happen. It's a bit of a contaminating your witness pool that way. So we were able to determine that, yeah, there could be some priming going on as people saw in this message what they wanted to see. But we're hoping that we can clarify that stuff and divine exactly what it says, and that would eliminate one way or another. We'd either find out it had nothing to do with Roswell or it had to do with weather balloons, or if it says victims of the wreck, we've got a whole other kettle of fish.
That's right. Wow. Kevin, I don't know where the time went, but we're right at the end.
I cannot believe that.
We went pretty fast. I would like to have you back on again, and we can explore some other topics if you're up.
Just keep sending the money.
Yes, it's in the mail. So
yes, you said that, didn't you?
Yeah. Hey, so where can someone find your Blogspot?
There you go, Blogspot. It's at kevinrandall.blogspot.com. They type a different perspective into Google, and that's usually the first thing that comes up now in a Google search is a different perspective. Type my name into it, Kevin Randall, and it's R-A-N-D-L-E. Type my name into it, and you'll come to that. You'll also find that a guy named Kevin Randall was picked up for drunk driving in Florida, but I can prove it was not me because at the time he was picked up for drunk driving, I was actually in Iraq. So I'm cleared on that one.
And you have documents to verify this?
Yes. In fact, I was just awarded the Bronze Star for my service in Iraq, and it gives the dates of service. So, yes, I've got documentation.
That's good.
But if they go to Amazon.com, there's Kindle books, so they could, like, be reading my stuff in a minute. And a couple of things are, like, 99 cents. So it's, you know, book-length manuscripts for 99 cents. And there's some science fiction up there. There's a nice little book called Conversations that really was an abduction investigation that went in a bizarre direction. So there's some stuff there. So they can look at my blog, they can look at the books, or they can just ignore everything.
All right, great. Well, you take care, Kevin.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Well, that's it for our show today. If you missed any part of this show, you can catch it as a podcast and a whole bunch of other free podcasts on our website, which is podcastufo.com. Also, you can check out links to the stories in our show notes, as well as joining in the conversation in our forums. I want to thank everyone that helped out today, including Carrie Lloyd Whitehouse for our music, Keith Rowland, the producer of Dark Matter Radio Network, as well as Peggy Shunning for adminning our Facebook page. Remember to like us on Facebook for all the latest UFO and astronomy news. You can check us out live next week right here and every week after at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 1 a.m. UTC, right here on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Remember to keep Keep your eyes to the sky and your curiosity high. This is Martin Willis, and bye for now.